But Walder Frey could not match his gluttony, though she did manage 3 slices herself. Ramsay ate heartily as well, though his pale bride did no more than stare at the portion set before her. When she raised her head and looked at Theon, he could see the fear behind her big brown eyes. No long swords had been allowed within the hall, but every man there wore a dagger, even Theon Greyjoy. How else to cut his meat? Every time he looked at the girl who had been Jane Poole, he felt the presence of that steel at his side. "I've no way to save her," he thought, "but I could kill her easy enough. No one would expect it. I could beg her for the honour of a dance and cut her throat. That would be a kindness, wouldn't it? And if the old guard hear my prayer, Ramsay, in his wrath, might strike me dead as well." Theon was not afraid to die. Underneath the Dreadfort, he'd learned that there were far worse things than death. Ramsay had taught him that lesson, finger by finger and toe by toe, and it was not one that he was ever like to forget. "You do not eat," observed Lady Dustin. "No." Eating was hard for him. Ramsay had left him with so many broken teeth that chewing was an agony. Drinking was easier, though he had to grasp the wine cup with both hands to keep from dropping it. "No taste for pork pie, my lord. The best pork pie we ever tasted, our fat friend would have us believe." She gestured towards Lord Manderley with her wine cup. "Have you ever seen a fat man so happy? He's almost dancing, serving with his own hands." It was true, the Lord of White Harbour was the very picture of the jolly fat man, laughing and smiling, japing with the other lords and slapping them on the back, calling out to the musicians for this tune or that tune. "Give us the night that ended, singer," he bellowed. "The bride will like that one, I know. Or sing to us of brave young Danny Flint and make a sweep." To look at him, you would have thought that he was the one newly wed. "He's drunk," said Theon, "drowning his fears. He's craven to the bone, that one." Was he? Theon was not certain. His sons had been fat as well, but they had not shamed themselves in battle. "Ironborn will feast before a battle too. A last taste of life should death await. If Stannis comes..." "He will. He must." Lady Dustin chuckled. "And when he does, the fat man will piss himself. His son died at the Red Wedding, yet he shared his bread and salt with Freys. Welcome them beneath his roof. Promise one his granddaughter. He even serves them pie. The Manderleys ran from the south once, hounded from their lands and keeps by enemies. Blood runs true. The fat man would like to kill us all, I do not doubt, but he does not have the belly for it, for all his girth. Under that sweaty flesh beats a heart as craven and cringing as, well, yours." Her last word was a lash, but Theon dared not answer back in kind. Any insolence would cost him skin. "If my lady believes Lord Manderley wants to betray us, Lord Bolton is the one to tell." "You think Roose does not know, silly boy? Watch him. Watch how he watches Manderley. No dish so much as touches Roose's lips until he sees Lord Wyman eat of it first. No cup of wine is sipped until he sees Manderley drink of the same cask. I think he would be pleased if the fat man attempted some betrayal. It would amuse him. Roose has no feelings, you see. Those leeches that he loved so well sucked all the passions out of him years ago. He does not love, he does not hate, he does not grieve. This is a game to him, mildly diverting. Some men hunt, some hawk, some tumble dice. Roose plays with men. You and me, these Freys, Lord Manderley, his plump new wife, even his bastard, we are but his playthings. A serving man was passing by. Lady Dustin held out her wine cup and let him fill it, then gestured for him to do the same for Theon. "Truth be told," she said, "Lord Bolton aspires to more than mere lordship. Why not King of the North? Tywin Lannister is dead, the Kingslayer is maimed, the imp is fled. The Lannisters are a spent force, and you were kind enough to rid him of the Starks. Old Walder Frey will not object to his fat little Walder becoming a queen. White Harbour might prove troublesome, should Lord Wyman survive this coming battle, but I am quite sure that he will not. No more than Stannis. Roose will remove Bolton, as he removed the young wolf. Who else is there?" "You," said Theon, "there is you, the lady of Barrowton, a Dustin by marriage, a Risewell by birth." That pleased her. She took a sip of wine, her dark eyes sparkling, and said, "The widow of Barrowton, and yes, if I so choose, I could be an inconvenience. Of course, Roose sees that too, so he takes care to keep me sweet." She might have said more, but then she saw the maesters. Three of them had entered together by the lord's door behind the dais, one tall, one plump, one very young. But in their robes and chains, they were three grey peas from a black pod. Before the war, Medric had served Lord Hornwood, Rodri, Lord Servin, and young Henley, Lord Slate. Roose Bolton had brought them all to Winterfell to take charge of Lewin's ravens, so messages might be sent and received from here again. As Maester Medric went to one knee to whisper in Bolton's ear, Lady Dustin's mouth twisted in distaste. "If I were a queen, the first thing I would do would be to kill all those grey rats. They scurry everywhere, living on the leavings of the lords, chittering to one another, whispering in the ears of their masters. But who are the masters, and who are the servants, truly? Every great lord has his maester. Every lesser lord aspires to one. If you do not have a maester, it is taken to mean that you are of little consequence. The grey rats read and write our letters, even for such lords as cannot read themselves. And who can say for a certainty that they are not twisting the words for their own ends? What good are they? I ask you." "They heal," said Theon. It seemed to be expected of him. "They heal, yes. I never said they were not subtle. They tend to us when we are sick and injured, or distraught over the illness of a parent or a child. Whenever we are weakest and most vulnerable, there they are. Sometimes they heal us, and we are duly grateful. When they fail, they console us in our grief, and we are grateful for that as well. Out of gratitude, we give them a place beneath our roof, and make them privy to all our shames and secrets, a part of every council. And before too long, the ruler has become the ruled." That was how it was with Lord Rickard Stark. Maester Wallace was his grey rat's name. And isn't it clever how the maesters go by only one name? Even those who had two when they first arrived at the Citadel. That way we cannot know who they truly are or where they come from. But if you are dogged enough, you can still find out. Before he forged his chain, Maester Wallace had been known as Wallace Flowers. Flowers, hill, rivers, snow, we give such names to base-born children to mark them for what they are. But they are always quick to shed them. Wallace Flowers had a high-tower girl for a mother and an archmaester of the Citadel for a father, it was rumoured. The grey rats are not as chaste as they would have us believe. Old-town maesters are the worst of all. Once he forged his chain, his secret father and his friends wasted no time dispatching him to Winterfell to fill Lord Rickard's ears with poisoned words as sweet as honey. The Tully marriage was his notion. Never doubt it, he...
She broke off as Roose Bolton rose to his feet, pale eyes shining in the torchlight. "My friends," he began, and a hush swept through the hall, so profound that Theon could hear the wind plucking at the boards over the windows. "Stannis and his knights have left Deepwood Mott, flying the banner of his new Red Guard. The clans of the Northern Hills come with him on their shaggy, runtish horses. If the weather holds, they could be on us in a fortnight, and Crow Food Umber marches down the King's Road, whilst the Carstarks approach from the east. They mean to join with Lord Stannis here, and take this castle from us." Sir Hustine Frey pushed to his feet.
"We should ride forth to meet them. Why allow them to combine their strength?"
"Because Arnulf Carstark awaits only a sign from Lord Bolton before he turns his cloak," thought Theon, as the other lords began to shout out counsel.
Lord Bolton raised his hands for silence. "The hall is not the place for such discussions, my lords. Let us adjourn to the solar, whilst my son consummates his marriage. The rest of you remain and enjoy the food and drink." As the Lord of the Dreadfort slipped out, attended by the three maesters, other lords and captains rose to follow. Hother Umber, the gaunt old man called Horsebane, went grim-faced and scowling. Lord Manderley was so drunk he required four strong men to help him from the hall.
"We should have a song about the rat cook,"
he was muttering, as he staggered past Theon, leaning on his knights.
"Singer, give us a song about the rat cook."
Lady Dustin was amongst the last to bestir herself. When she had gone, all at once the hall seemed stifling. It was not until Theon pushed himself to his feet that he realized how much he'd drunk. When he stumbled from the table, he knocked a flagon from the hands of a serving girl. Wine splashed across his boots and breeches, a dark red tide. A hand grabbed his shoulder, five fingers hard as iron digging deep into his flesh.
"You're wanted, Reek," said Sir Alan, his breath foul with the smell from his rotten teeth.
Yellowdick and Damon Dancemy were with him.
"Ramsay says you're to bring his bride to his bed."
A shiver of fear went through him. "I played my part," he thought. "Why me?" He knew better than to object, though. Lord Ramsay had already left the hall. His bride, forlorn and seemingly forgotten, sat hunched and silent beneath the banner of House Stark, clutching a silver goblet in both hands. Judging from the way she looked at him when he approached, she had emptied that goblet more than once. Perhaps she hoped that if she drank enough, the ordeal would pass her by. Theon knew better.
"Lady Arya," he said, "come, it's time you did your duty."
Six of the bastard's boys accompanied them as Theon led the girl out of the back of the hall and across the frigid yard to the great keep. It was up three flights of stone steps to Lord Ramsay's bedchamber. One of the rooms the fires had touched but lightly. As they climbed, Damon Dancemy whistled, while Skinner boasted that Lord Ramsay had promised him a piece of the bloody sheet as a mark of special favour. The bedchamber had been well prepared for the consummation. All the furnishings were new, brought up from Barrowton in the baggage train. The canopy bed had a feather mattress and drapes of blood-red velvet. The stone floor was covered with wolf skins. A fire was burning in the hearth, a candle on the bedside table. On the sideboard was a flagon of wine, two cups, and a half-wheel of veined white cheese. There was a chair as well, carved of black oak, with a red leather seat. Lord Ramsay was seated in it when they entered. Spittle glistened on his lips.
"There's my sweet maid. Good lads. You may leave us now. Not you, Reek. You stay. Reek. Reek. It rhymes with peak.
He could feel his missing fingers cramping. Two on his left hand, one on his right. And on his hip, his dagger rested, sleeping in its leather sheath. But heavy, oh, so heavy.
It is only my pinky gone on my right hand, Theon reminded himself. I can still grip a knife. My lord, how may I serve you?
You gave the wench to me. Who better to unwrap the gift? Let's have a look at Ned Stark's little daughter.
She is no kin to Lord Eddard,
Theon almost said.
Ramsay knows. He has to know. What new cruel game is this?
The girl was standing by a bedpost, trembling like a doe.
Lady Arya, if you will turn your back, I must needs unlace your gown.
No. Lord Ramsay poured himself a cup of wine.
Laces take too long. Cut it off her.
Theon drew the dagger.
All I need to do is turn and stab him. The knife is in my hand.
He knew the game by then. Another trap, he told himself, remembering Kyra with her keys.
He wants me to try and kill him. And when I fail, he'll flay the skin from the hand I used to hold the blade.
He grabbed a handful of the bride's skirt.
Stand still, my lady.
The gown was loose below the waist, so that was where he slid the blade in, slicing upward slowly, so as not to cut her. Steel whispered through wool and silk with a faint, soft sound. The girl was shaking. Theon had to grab her arm to hold her still.
Jane, Jane, it rhymes with pain.
He tightened his grip, as much as his maimed left hand would allow.
Stay still.
Finally the gown fell away, a pale tangle round her feet.
Her small clothes, too,
Ramsay commanded. Reek obeyed. When it was done, the bride stood naked, her bridal finery a heap of white and grey rags about her feet. Her breasts were small and pointed, her hips narrow and girlish, her legs as skinny as a bird's.
A child!
Theon had forgotten how young she was.
Sansa's age. Arya would be even younger.
Despite the fire in the hearth, the bedchamber was chilly. Jane's pale skin was pebbled with goose prickles. There was a moment when her hands rose, as if she was about to cover her breasts, but Theon mouthed a silent no, and she saw, and stopped at once.
"What do you think of her, Reek?" asked Lord Ramsay. What answer does he want? What was it the girl had said before the gods would? They all said that I was pretty.
She was not pretty now. He could see a spider web of faint, thin lines across her back where someone had whipped her.
She is beautiful, so beautiful.
Ramsay smiled his wet smile.
Does she make your cock hard, Reek? Is it straining against your laces? Would you like to fuck her first? He laughed. The Prince of Winterfell should have that right, as all lords did in days of old. The first night. But you're no lord, are you? Only Reek. Not even a man, truth be told.
He took another gulp of wine, then threw the cup across the room to shatter off a wall. Red rivers ran down across the stone.
Lady Arya, get on the bed.
Yes, against the pillows. That's a good wife.
Now spread your legs, and let us see your cunt.
The girl obeyed, wordless. Theon took a step back toward the door. Lord Ramsay sat beside his bride, slid his hand along her inner thigh, then jammed two fingers up inside her. The girl let out a gasp of pain.
"You're dry as an old bone."
Ramsay pulled his hand free and slapped her face.
"I was told that you'd know how to please a man." "Was that a lie?"
No, my lord, I was trained.
Ramsay rose, the firelight shining on his face. "Reek, get over here. Get her ready for me." For a moment he did not understand.
Do you mean, my lord, I have no...
"With your mouth," Lord Ramsay said, "and be quick about it. If she is not wet by the time I have done disrobing, I will cut off that tongue of yours and nail it to the wall." Somewhere in the God's Wood, a raven screamed. The dagger was still in his hand. He sheathed it. "Reek, my name is Reek. It rhymes with weak." Reek bent to his task. The Watcher. "Let us look upon this head," his prince commanded. Aryahotar ran his hand along the smooth shaft of his long axe, his ash and iron wife, all the while watching. He watched the White Knight, Sir Balon Swan, and the others who had come with him. He watched the Sand Snakes, each at a different table. He watched the lords and ladies, the serving men, the old blind seneschal, and the young maester, Miles, with his silky beard and servile smile. Standing half in light and half in shadow, he saw all of them.
"Serve, protect, obey." That was his task.
All the rest had eyes only for the chest. It was carved of ebony, with silver clasps and hinges. A fine-looking box, no doubt, but many of those assembled here in the old palace of Sunspear might soon be dead, depending on what was in that chest. His slippers whispering against the floor, Maester Kaliot crossed the hall to Sir Balon Swan. The round little man looked splendid in his new robes, with their broad bands of dun and butternut and narrow stripes of red. Bowing, he took the chest from the hands of the White Knight and carried it to the dais, where Doran Martell sat in his rolling chair between his daughter Ariane and his dead brother's beloved paramour, Elaria. 100 scented candles perfumed the air. Gemstones glittered on the fingers of the lords and the girdles and hairnets of the ladies. Aryahotar had polished his shirt of copper scales mirror bright, so he would blaze in the candlelight as well. A hush had fallen across the hall. "Dawn holds its breath." Maester Kaliot set the box on the floor beside Prince Doran's chair. The maester's fingers, normally so sure and deft, turned clumsy as he worked the latch and opened the lid to reveal the skull within. Hotar heard someone clear his throat. One of the Thala twins whispered something to the other. Elaria Sand had closed her eyes and was murmuring a prayer. Sir Balon Swan was taut as a drawn bow, the captain of guards observed. This new White Knight was not so tall nor comely as the old one, but he was bigger across the chest, burlier, his arms thick with muscle. His snowy cloak was clasped at the throat by two swans on a silver brooch. One was ivory, the other onyx, and it seemed to Aryahotar as if the two of them were fighting. The man who wore them looked a fighter, too.
"This one will not die so easy as the other. He will not charge into my axe the way Sir Ares did. He will stand behind his shield and make me come at him."
If it came to that, Hotar would be ready. His long axe was sharp enough to shave with. He allowed himself a brief glance at the chest. The skull rested on a bed of black felt, grinning. All skulls grinned, but this one seemed happier than most.
"And bigger."
The captain of guards had never seen a larger skull. Its brow shelf was thick and heavy, its jaw massive. The bone shone in the candlelight, white as Sir Balon's cloak.
"Place it on the pedestal," the prince commanded.
He had tears glistening in his eyes. The pedestal was a column of black marble, 3 feet taller than Maester Kaliot. The fat little maester hopped up on his toes, but still could not quite reach. Aryahotar was about to go and help him, but Obara Sand moved first. Even without her whip and shield, she had an angry, mannish look to her. In place of a gown, she wore men's breeches and a calf-length linen tunic, cinched at the waist with a belt of copper suns. Her brown hair was tied back in a knot. Snatching the skull from the maester's soft pink hands, she placed it up atop the marble column. "The mountain rides no more," the prince said gravely.
"Was his dying long and hard, Sir Balin?" asked Hain Sand, in the tone a maiden might use to ask if her gown was pretty.
"He screamed for days, milady," the white knight replied, though it was plain that it pleased him little to say so. "We could hear him all over the Red Keep."
"Does that trouble you, sir?"
asked the Lady Nim. She wore a gown of yellow silk, so sheer and fine that the candles shone right through it to reveal the spun gold and jewels beneath. So immodest was her garb that the white knight seemed uncomfortable looking at her, but Hotar approved. Nymeria was least dangerous when nearly naked. Elsewise she was sure to have a dozen blades concealed about her person.
"Sir Gregor was a bloody brute. All men agree. If ever a man deserved to suffer, it was him."
"That is as it may be, my lady," said Balin Swan. "But Sir Gregor was a knight, and a knight should die with sword in hand. Poison is a foul and filthy way to kill." Lady Tyene smiled at that. Her gown was cream and green, with long lace sleeves, so modest and so innocent that any man who looked at her might think her the most chaste of maids. Arya Hotar knew better. Her soft, pale hands were as deadly as Obara's calloused ones, if not more so. He watched her carefully, alert to every little flutter of her fingers. Prince Doran frowned.
"That is so, Sir Balin, but the Lady Nim is right. If ever a man deserved to die screaming, it was Gregor Clegane. He butchered my good sister, smashed her babe's head against a wall. I only pray that now he is burning in some hell, and that Elia and her children are at peace. This is the justice that Dawn has hungered for. I am glad that I lived long enough to taste it. At long last, the Lannisters have proved the truth of their boast and paid this old blood debt."
The prince left her to Ricasso, his blind seneschal, to rise and propose the toast.
"Lords and ladies, let us now drink to Tommen, the first of his name, King of the Andals, the Ronar, and the First Men, and Lord of the Seven Kingdoms."
Serving men had begun to move amongst the guests as the seneschal was speaking, filling cups from the flagons that they bore. The wine was Dornish strong wine, dark as blood and sweet as vengeance. The captain did not drink of it. He never drank at feasts, nor did the prince himself partake. He had his own wine, prepared by Maester Miles, and well laced with poppy juice to ease the agony in his swollen joints. The white knight did drink, as was only courteous, his companions likewise. So did the Princess Ariane, Lady Jourdain, the Lord of God's Grace, the Knight of Lemonwood, the Lady of Ghost Hill, even Ilaria Sand, Prince Oberyn's beloved paramour, who had been with him in King's Landing when he died. Hotar paid more note to those who did not drink, Sir Damon Sand, Lord Tremond Gargallon, the Fowler twins, Dagus Manwoody, the Ullers of the Hellholt, the Wills of the Boneway.
"If there is trouble, it could start with one of them."
Dawn was an angry and divided land, and Prince Doran's hold on it was not as firm as it might be. Many of his own lords thought him weak, and would have welcomed open war with the Lannisters and the boy king on the Iron Throne. Chief amongst those were the Sand Snakes, the bastard daughters of the prince's late brother Oberyn, the Red Viper. three of whom had been at the feast. Doran Martell was the wisest of princes, and it was not the place of his captain of guards to question his decisions. But Arya Hotar did wonder why he had chosen to release the ladies Obara, Nymeria, and Tyeen from their lonely cells in the Spear Tower. Tyeen declined Ricasso's toast with a murmur, and Lady Nym with a flick of a hand. Obara let them fill her cup to the brim, then upended it to spill the red wine on the floor. When a serving girl knelt to wipe up the spilled wine, Obara left the hall. After a moment, Princess Ariane excused herself and went after her.
"Obara would never turn her rage on the little princess," Hotar knew. "They are cousins, and she loves her well."
The feast continued late into the night, presided over by the grinning skull on its pillar of black marble. Seven courses were served, in honour of the seven gods and the seven brothers of the king's god. The soup was made with eggs and lemons, the long green peppers stuffed with cheese and onions. There were lamprey pies, capons glazed with honey, a whisker fish from the bottom of the green blood that was so big it took four serving men to carry it to table. After that came a savoury snake stew, chunks of seven different sorts of snake, slow-simmered with dragon peppers and blood oranges, and a dash of venom to give it a good bite. The stew was fiery hot, Hotar knew, though he tasted none of it. Sherbet followed, to cool the tongue. For the sweet, each guest was served a skull of spun sugar. When the crust was broken, they found sweet custard inside, and bits of plum and cherry. Princess Ariane returned in time for the stuffed peppers.
"My little princess," Hotar thought.
But Ariane was a woman now. The scarlet silks she wore left no doubt of that. Of late she had changed in other ways as well. Her plot to crown Mycella had been betrayed and smashed. Her white knight had perished bloodily at Hotar's hand, and she herself had been confined to the Spear Tower, condemned to solitude and silence. All of that had chastened her. There was something else as well, though, some secret. Her father had confided in her before releasing her from her confinement. What that was, the captain did not know. The prince had placed his daughter between himself and the White Knight, a place of high honour. Ariane smiled as she slipped into her seat again and murmured something in Sir Balin's ear. The knight did not choose to respond. He ate little, Hotar observed. A spoon of soup, a bite of the pepper, the leg off a capon, some fish. He shunned the lamprey pie and tried only one small spoonful of the stew. Even that made his brow break out in sweat. Hotar could sympathize. When first he came to Dawn, the fiery food would tie his bowels in knots and burn his tongue. That was years ago, however. Now his hair was white, and he could eat anything a Dornish man could. When the spun sugar skulls were served, Sir Balin's mouth grew tight, and he gave the prince a lingering look to see if he was being mocked. Doran Martell took no notice, but his daughter did.
"It is the cook's little jeep, Sir Balin," said Ariane. "Even death is not sacred to a Dornishman. You won't be cross with us, I pray."
She brushed the back of the White Knight's hand with her fingers.
"I hope you have enjoyed your time in Dorne."
"Everyone has been most hospitable, milady." Ariane touched the pin that clasped his cloak, with its quarrelling swans.
"I have always been fond of swans. No other bird is half so beautiful this side of the Summer Isles."
"Your peacocks might dispute that," said Sir Balin.
"They might," said Ariane. "But peacocks are vain, proud creatures, strutting about in all those gaudy colours. Give me a swan serene in white, or beautiful in black."
Sir Balin gave a nod and sipped his wine.
This one is not so easily seduced as was his sworn brother,
Hotar thought.
Sir Eris was a boy despite his years. This one is a man and weary.
The captain had only to look at him to see that the white knight was ill at ease.
This place is strange to him, and a little to his liking.
Hotar could understand that. Dorne had seemed a queer place to him as well, when first he came here, with his own princess, many years ago. The bearded priests had drilled him in the common speech of Westeros before they sent him forth, but the Dornish men all spoke too quickly for him to understand. Dornish women were lewd, Dornish wine was sour, and Dornish food was full of queer, hot spices. And the Dornish sun was hotter than the pale one sun of Norvas, glaring down from a blue sky day after day. Sir Balin's journey had been shorter, but troubling in its own way, the captain knew. 3 knights, 8 squires, 20 men-at-arms, and sundry grooms and servants had accompanied him from King's Landing. But once they crossed the mountains into Dorne, their progress had been slowed by a round of feasts, hunts, and celebrations at every castle they had chanced to pass. And now that they had reached Sunspear, neither Princess Marcella nor Sir Aerys Oakheart was on hand to greet them.
"The White Knight knows that something is amiss,"
Hotar could tell.
"But it is more than that."
Perhaps the presence of the Sand Snakes unnerved him. If so, Obara's return to the hall must have been vinegar in the wound. She slipped back into her place without a word, and sat there sullen and scowling, neither smiling nor speaking. Midnight was close at hand when Prince Doran turned to the White Knight and said, "Sir Balin, I have read the letter that you brought me from our gracious queen. Might I assume that you are familiar with its contents, sir?" Hotar saw the knight tense. "I am, my lord. Her Grace informed me that I might be called upon to escort her daughter back to King's Landing. King Tommen has been pining for his sister, and would like Princess Marcella to return to court for a short visit." Princess Ariane made a sad face.
"Oh, but we have all grown so fond of Marcella, sir. She and my brother, Tristane, have become inseparable."
"Prince Tristane would be welcoming King's Landing as well," said Balon Swan. "King Tommen would wish to meet him, I am sure. His Grace has so few companions near his own age."
"The bonds formed in boyhood can last a man for life," said Prince Doran. "When Tristane and Marcella are wed, he and Tommen will be as brothers. Queen Cersei has the right of it. The boys should meet, become friends. Dawn will miss him, to be sure, but it is past time Tristane saw something of the world beyond the walls of Sunspear."
"I know King's Landing will welcome him most warmly."
"Why is he sweating now?" the captain wondered, watching. "The hall is cool enough, but he never touched the stew."
"As for the other matter that Queen Cersei raises," Prince Doran was saying,
"it is true Dorne's seat upon the small council has been vacant since my brother's death, and it is past time that it was filled again. I am flattered that Her Grace feels my council might be of use to her, though I wonder if I have the strength for such a journey. Perhaps if we went by sea..."
"By ship?" Sir Balin seemed taken aback.
Would that be safe, my prince?"
"Autumn is a bad season for storms, or so I've heard, and the pirates in the Stepstones, the pirates, to be sure, you may be right, sir. Safer to return the way you came." Prince Doran smiled pleasantly.
"Let us talk again on the morrow. When we reach the water gardens, we can tell Marcella. I know how excited she will be. She misses her brother, too, I do not doubt."
"I am eager to see her once again," said Sir Balin, "and to visit your water gardens. I've heard they are very beautiful." "Beautiful and peaceful," the prince said. "Cool breezes, sparkling water, and the laughter of children. The water gardens are my favourite place in this world, sir. One of my ancestors had them built to please his Targaryen bride and free her from the dust and heat of Sunspear. Daenerys was her name. She was sister to King Daeron the Good, and it was her marriage that made Dawn part of the Seven Kingdoms. The whole realm knew that the girl loved Daeron's bastard brother, Daemon Blackfyre, and was loved by him in turn. But the king was wise enough to see that the good of thousands must come before the desires of two, even if those two were dear to him. It was Daenerys who filled the gardens with laughing children, her own children at the start, but later the sons and daughters of lords and landed knights were brought in to be companions to the boys and girls of princely blood. And one summer's day, when it was scorching hot, she took pity on the children of her grooms and cooks and serving men, and invited them to use the pools and fountains too, a tradition that has endured to this day. The prince grasped the wheels of his chair and pushed himself from the table. "But now you must excuse me, sir. All this talk has wearied me, and we should leave at break of day. Obara, would you be so kind as to help me to my bed? Nymeria, Tyene, come as well, and bid your old uncle a fond good night." So it fell to Obaris then to roll the prince's chair from Sunspear's feast hall and down a long gallery to his solar. Arya-Hotar followed with her sisters, along with Princess Arianne and Ilaria Sand. Maester Caliot hurried behind on slippered feet, cradling the mountain skull as if it were a child. "You cannot seriously intend to send Tristane and Myrcella to King's Landing," Obara said as she was pushing. Her strides were long and angry, much too fast, and the chair's big wooden wheels clacked noisily across rough-cut stone floors. "Do that, and we will never see the girl again, and your son will spend his life a hostage to the Iron Throne." "Do you take me for a fool, Obara?" the prince sighed. "There is much you do not know. Things best not discussed here, where anyone can hear. If you hold your tongue, I may enlighten you." He winced. "Slower, for the love you bear me. Ugh, that last jolt sent a knife right through my knee." Obara slowed her pace by half. "What will you do, then?" Her sister Tyene gave answer. "What he always does," she purred. "Delay, obscure, prevaricate. Oh, no one does that half so well as our brave uncle."
"You do him wrong," said Princess Arianne. "Be quiet, all of you," the prince commanded.
Not until the doors of his solar were safely closed behind them did he wheel his chair about to face the women. Even that effort left him breathless, and the mirrorish blanket that covered his legs caught between two spokes as he rolled, so he had to clutch it to keep it from being torn away. Beneath the coverlet, his legs were pale, soft, ghastly. Both of his knees were red and swollen, and his toes were almost purple, twice the size they should have been. Arya-Hotar had seen them 1,000 times, and still found them hard to look upon. Princess Arianne came forward.
"Let me help you, father."
The prince pulled the blanket free.
"I can still master mine own blanket, that much at least."
It was little enough. His legs had been useless for 3 years, but there was still some strength in his hands and shoulders.
"Shall I fetch my prince a thimble cup of milk of the poppy?" Maester Caliot asked. "I would need a bucket with this pain. Thank you, but no. I want my wits about me. I'll have no more need of you tonight." "Very good, my prince."
Maester Caliot bowed, Sir Gregor's head still clutched in his soft pink hands.
I'll take that.
Obarus End plucked the skull from him and held it at arm's length.
What did the mountain look like?
How do we know that this is him? They could have dipped the head in tar. Why strip it to the bone?
Tar would have ruined the box, suggested Lady Nim, as Maester Caryout scurried off.
No one saw the mountain die, and no one saw his head removed. That troubles me, I confess. But what could the Bitch Queen hope to accomplish by deceiving us? If Gregor Clegane is alive, soon or late the truth will out. The man was 8 feet tall. There's not another like him in all of Westeros. If any such appears again, Cersei Lannister will be exposed as a liar before all the 7 kingdoms. She would be an utter fool to risk that. What could she hope to gain?
The skull is large enough, no doubt, said the prince, and we know that Oberyn wounded Gregor grievously. Every report we have had since claims that Clegane died slowly, in great pain.
Just as father intended, said Tyene. Sisters, truly, I know the poison father used. If his spear so much as broke the mountain's skin, Clegane is dead. I do not care how big he was. Doubt your little sister if you like, but never doubt our sire.
Obara bristled.
I never did, and never shall.
She gave the skull a mocking kiss.
This is a start, I'll grant.
A start, said Ilaria Sand, incredulous. Gods forbid I would it were a finish. Tywin Lannister is dead. So are Robert Baratheon, Aemery Lorch, and now Gregor Clegane. All those who had a hand in murdering Elia and her children. Even Joffrey, who was not yet born when Elia died. I saw the boy perish with mine own eyes, clawing at his throat as he tried to draw a breath.
Who else is there to kill?
Do Myrcella and Tommen need to die, so the shades of Rhaenys and Aegon can be at rest? Where does it end?
It ends in blood, as it began, said Lady Nim. It ends when Castle Rock is cracked open, so the sun can shine on the maggots and the worms within. It ends with the utter ruin of Tywin Lannister and all his works. The man died at the hand of his own son, Ilaria snapped back. What more could you wish?
I could wish that he died at my hand.
Lady Nim settled in a chair, her long black braid falling across one shoulder to her lap. She had her father's widow's peak. Beneath it, her eyes were large and lustrous. Her wine-red lips curled in a silken smile. If he had, his dying would not have been so easy.
Sir Gregor does look lonely, said Tyene, in her sweet scepter's voice. He would like some company, I'm certain.
Ilaria's cheeks were wet with tears, her dark eyes shining.
Even weeping, she has a strength in her, the captain thought. Oberyn wanted vengeance for Elia. Now the three of you want vengeance for him. I have 4 daughters, I remind you. Your sisters. Maelia is 14, almost a woman. Obella is 12, on the brink of maidenhood. They worship you, as Doria and Nereza worship them. If you should die, must Eel and Obella seek vengeance for you, then Doria and Lorry for them. Is that how it goes? Round and round forever. I ask you, where does it end?
Ilaria Sand laid her hand on the mountain's head.
I saw your father die. Here is his killer. Can I take a skull to bed with me, to give me comfort in the night? Will it make me laugh, write me songs, care for me when I am old and sick?
What will you have us do, my lady? Asked the Lady Nim. Shall we lay down our spears and smile, and forget all the wrongs that have been done to us?
"War will come, whether we wish it or not," said Obara. "A boy king sits the Iron Throne. Lord Stannis holds the war and is gathering Northmen to his cause. The two queens are squabbling over Tommen like bitches with a juicy bone. The Iron Men have taken the shields and are raiding up the Mander, deep into the heart of the Reach, which means Highgarden will be preoccupied as well. Our enemies are in disarray. The time is ripe."
"Ripe for what? To make more skulls?"
Ilaria Sand turned to the prince.
"They will not see. I can hear no more of this."
"Go back to your girls, Ilaria," the prince told her. "I swear to you, no harm will come to them."
"My prince,"
Ilaria kissed him on the brow and took her leave. Arya Hotar was sad to see her go.
"She is a good woman."
When she had gone, Lady Nym said, "I know she loved our father well, but it is plain she never understood him." The prince gave her a curious look.
"She understood more than you ever will, Nymeria.
And she made your father happy. In the end, a gentle heart may be worth more than pride or valor. Be that as it may, there are things Ilaria does not know and should not know. This war has already begun." Obara laughed. "Aye, our sweet Ariane has seen to that." The princess flushed, and Hotar saw a spasm of anger pass across her father's face.
"What she did as much for you as for herself. I would not be so quick to mock."
"That was praise," Obara Sand insisted. "Procrastinate, obscure, prevaricate, dissemble, and delay all you like, uncle. Sir Balin must still come face to face with Myrcella at the Water Gardens, and when he does, he is like to see she's short an ear. And when the girl tells him how your captain cut Aerys Oakheart from neck to groin with that steel wife of his, well..." "No." Princess Ariane unfolded from the cushion where she sat and put a hand on Hotar's arm.
"That wasn't how it happened, cousin. Sir Aerys was slain by Geraldine."
The Sand Snakes looked at one another.
"Darkstar?"
"Darkstar did it," his little princess said.
"He tried to kill Princess Myrcella too, as she will tell Sir Balin."
Nym smiled. "That part at least is true."
"It is all true," said the prince, with a wince of pain. "Is it his gout that hurts him, or the lie? And now Sir Gerald has fled back to High Hermitage, beyond our reach."
"Darkstar," Tyeen murmured with a giggle. "Why not? It's all his doing, but will Sir Balin believe it?"
"He will if he hears it from Myrcella," Ariane insisted.
Obara snorted in disbelief. "She may lie today and lie tomorrow, but soon or late she'll tell the truth. If Sir Balin is allowed to carry tales back to King's Landing, drums will sound and blood will flow. He should not be allowed to leave."
"We could kill him, to be sure," said Tyeen. "But then we would need to kill the rest of his party, too, even those sweet young squires. That would be, oh, so messy."
Prince Doran shut his eyes and opened them again. Hotar could see his leg trembling underneath the blanket.
"If you were not my brother's daughters, I would send the three of you back to yourselves and keep you there until your bones were grey. Instead, I mean to take you with us to the Water Gardens. There are lessons there, if you have the wit to see them."
"Lessons," said Obara, "all I've seen are naked children."
"Ay," the prince said, "I told the story to Sir Balin, but not all of it. As the children splashed in the pools, Daenerys watched from amongst the orange trees, and a realization came to her. She could not tell the highborn from the low. Naked, they were only children, all innocent, all vulnerable, all deserving of long life, love,
protection.
There is your realm, she told her son and heir. Remember them in everything you do.
My own mother said those same words to me when I was old enough to leave the pools. It is an easy thing for a prince to call the spears, but in the end, the children pay the price. For their sake, the wise prince will wage no war without good cause, nor any war he cannot hope to win. I am not blind, nor deaf. I know that you all believe me weak, frightened, feeble. Your father knew me better. Oberyn was ever the viper, deadly, dangerous, unpredictable. No man dared tread on him. I was the grass, pleasant, complacent, sweet-smelling, swaying with every breeze. Who fears to walk upon the grass? But it is the grass that hides the viper from his enemies and shelters him until he strikes. Your father and I worked more closely than you know, but now he's gone. The question is, can I trust his daughters to serve me in his place? Hottar studied each of them in turn. Obara rusted nails and boiled leather, with her angry, close-set eyes and rat-brown hair. Nymeria, languid, elegant, olive-skinned, her long black braid bound up in red-gold wire. Tyene, blue-eyed and blonde, a child-woman, with her soft hands and little giggles. Tyene answered for the three of them.
It is doing nothing that is hard, uncle. Set a task for us, any task, and you shall find us as leal and obedient as any prince could hope for.
That is good to hear, the prince said, but words are wind. You are my brother's daughters, and I love you, but I have learned I cannot trust you. I want your oath. Will you swear to serve me to do as I command?
If we must, said Lady Nym, then swear it now, upon your father's grave.
Obara's face darkened.
If you were not my uncle, I am your uncle, and your prince. Swear or go.
I swear, said Tyene, on my father's grave.
I swear, said Lady Nym, by Oberyn Martell, the Rand Viper of Dawn, and a better man than you.
I, said Obara, me as well. By father, I swear.
Some of the tension went out of the prince. Hottar saw him sag back into his chair. He held out his hand, and Princess Ariane moved to his side to hold it.
Tell them, father.
Prince Doran took a jagged breath.
Dorn still has friends at court. Friends who tell us things we were not meant to know. This invitation Cersei sent us is a ruse. Tristan is never meant to reach King's Landing. On the road back, somewhere in the King's Wood, Sir Balin's party will be attacked by outlaws, and my son will die. I am asked to court only so that I may witness this attack with my own eyes, and thereby absolve the Queen of any blame.
Oh, and these outlaws, they will be shouting, "Half-man! Half-man!" as they attack. Sir Balin may even catch a quick glimpse of the imp, though no one else will.
Arya Hottar would not have believed it possible to shock the Sand Snakes. He would have been wrong.
Seven save us, whispered Tyene. Tristan, why?
The woman must be mad, Obara said. He's just a boy.
This is monstrous, said Lady Nym.
I would not have believed it. Not of a Kingsguard knight.
They are sworn to obey, just as my captain is, the prince said. I had my doubts as well, but you all saw how Sir Balin balked when I suggested that we go by sea. A ship would have disturbed all the queen's arrangements.
Obara's face was flushed.
Give me back my spear, uncle. Cersei sent us ahead. We should send her back a bag of them.
Prince Doran raised a hand.
His knuckles were as dark as cherries, and near as big. "Sir Balin, is a guest..."